This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents The Rise of Endymion, written by Dan Simmons and read by Victor Bavain.
Chapter 1. The Pope is dead. Long live the Pope! The cry reverberated in and around the Vatican courtyard of San Damaso, where the body of Pope Julius XIV had just been discovered in his papal apartments. The Holy Father had died in his sleep. Within minutes, the word spread through the mismatched cluster of buildings still referred to as the Vatican Palace, and then moved out through the Vatican State with the speed of a circuit fire in a pure oxygen environment. The rumor of the Pope's death burned through the Vatican's office complex, leaped through the crowded St. Anne's Gate to the Apostolic Palace and the adjacent Government Palace, found waiting ears among the faithful in the sacristy of St. Peter's Basilica, to the point that the Archbishop saying Mass actually turned to look over his shoulder at the unprecedented hiss and whispering of the congregation, and then moved out of the basilica with the departing worshippers into the larger crowds of St. Peter's Square, where 80 to 100,000 tourists and visiting PAX functionaries received the rumor like a critical mass of plutonium being slammed inward to full fission. Once out through the main vehicle gate of the Arch of Bells, the news accelerated to the speed of electrons, then leaped to the speed of light, and finally hurtled out and away from the planet Pachem at Hawking Drive velocities, thousands of times faster than light. Closer, just beyond the ancient walls of the Vatican, phones and comm logs chimed throughout the hulking, sweating Castel Sant'Angelo, where the offices of the Holy Office of the Inquisition were buried deep in the mountain of stone originally built to be Hadrian's mausoleum. All that morning, there was the rattle of beads and rustle of starched cassocks as Vatican functionaries rushed back to their offices to monitor their encrypted net lines and to wait for memos from above. Personal communicators rang, chimed, and vibrated in the uniforms and implants of thousands of PAX administrators, military commanders, politicians, and mercantilist officials. Within 30 minutes of the discovery of the Pope's lifeless body, news organizations around the world of Pachem were cued to the story. They readied their robotic holocams, brought their full panoply of in-system relay sats online, sent their best human reporters to the Vatican press office, and waited. In an interstellar society where the Church ruled all but absolutely, news awaited not only independent confirmation, but official permission to exist. 2 hours and 10 minutes after the discovery of Pope Julius XIV's body, the Church confirmed his death via an announcement through the office of the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Lourdes Sami. Within seconds, the recorded announcement was typecast to every radio and holovision on the teeming world of Pachem. With its population of 1.5 billion souls, all born-again Christians carrying the cruciform, most employed by the Vatican or the huge civilian, military, or mercantile bureaucracy of the PAX state, the planet Pachem paused to listen with some interest. Even before the formal announcement, a dozen of the new Archangel-class starships had left their orbital bases and translated across the small human sphere of the galaxy arm, their near-instantaneous drives instantly killing their crews, but carrying their message of the Pope's death secure in computers and coded transponders for the 60-some most important archdiocese worlds and star systems. These Archangel courier ships would carry a few of the voting cardinals back to Pachem in time for the election, but most of the electors would choose to remain on their home worlds, foregoing death even with its sure promise of resurrection, sending instead their encrypted, interactive holo-wafers with their eligo for the next supreme pontiff. Another 85 Hawking-class PAX ships, mostly high-acceleration torch ships, made ready to spin up to relativistic velocities and then into jump configurations, their voyage time to be measured in days to months, their relative time debt ranging from weeks to years. These ships would wait in Potsdam space the 15 to 20 standard days until the election of the new pope, and then bring the word to the 130-some less critical PAX systems, where archbishops tended to billions more of the faithful. Those archdiocese worlds, in turn, would be charged with sending the word of the pope's death, resurrection, and re-election on to lesser systems, distant worlds, and to the myriad colonies in the outback. A final fleet of more than 200 unmanned courier drones was taken out of storage at the huge PAX asteroid base in Potsdam system, their message chips waiting only for the official announcement of Pope Julius's rebirth and re-election before being accelerated into Hawking space to carry the news to elements of the PAX fleet engaged in patrol or combat with the ousters along the so-called Great Wall defensive sphere far beyond the boundaries of PAX space. Pope Julius had died 8 times before. The pontiff's heart was weak, and he would allow no repair of it, either by surgery or nanoplasty. It was his contention that a pope should live his natural lifespan and, upon his death, that a new pope should be elected. The fact that this same pope had been re-elected 8 times did not dissuade him from his opinion. Even now, as Pope Julius's body was being readied for a formal evening of lying in state before being carried to the private resurrection chapel behind St. Peter's, cardinals and their surrogates were making preparations for the election. The Sistine Chapel was closed to tourists and made ready for the voting that would occur in less than 3 weeks. Ancient canopied stalls were brought in for the 83 cardinals who would be present in the flesh, while holographic projectors and interactive datum plane connections were set in place for the cardinals who would vote by proxy. The table for the scrutineers was set in front of the chapel's high altar. Small cards, needles, thread, a receptacle, a plate, linen cloths, and other objects were carefully placed on the table of the scrutineers and then covered with a larger linen cloth. The table for the infirmari and the revisers was set to one side of the altar. The main doors of the Sistine Chapel were closed, bolted, and sealed. Swiss Guard commandos in full battle armor and state-of-the-art energy weapons took their place outside the chapel doors and at the blast-proof portals of St. Peter's Papal Resurrection Annex. Following ancient protocol, the election was scheduled to occur in no fewer than 15 days and no more than 20. Those cardinals who made their permanent home on Potsdam, or within 3 weeks' time debt travel, canceled their regular agendas and prepared for the enclave. Everything else was in readiness. Some fat men carry their weight like a weakness, a sign of self-indulgence and sloth. Other fat men absorb mass regally, an outward sign of their growing power. Simon Augustino Cardinal Lourdesami was of the latter category. A huge man, a veritable mountain of scarlet in his formal cardinal robes, Lourdesami looked to be in his late 50s, standard, and had appeared thus for more than 2 centuries of active life and successful resurrection. Jowled, quite bald, and given to speaking in a soft bass rumble that could rise to a god roar capable of filling St. Peter's Basilica without the use of a speaker system, Lourdesami remained the epitome of health and vitality in the Vatican. Many in the inner circles of the Church's hierarchy credited Lourdesami, then a young minor functionary in the Vatican diplomatic machine, with guiding the anguished and pain-ridden ex-Hyperion pilgrim, Father Lennar Hoyt, to finding the secret that tamed the cruciform to an instrument of resurrection. They credited him as much as the newly deceased pope with bringing the Church back from the brink of extinction. Whatever the truth of that legend, Lourdesami was in fine form this first day after the Holy Father's ninth death in office, and 5 days before His Holiness's resurrection. As Cardinal Secretary of State, President of the Committee overseeing the 12 sacred congregations, and Prefect of that most feared and misunderstood of those agencies, the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, now officially known once again after more than 1,000-year interregnum as the Holy Office of the Universal Inquisition, Lourdesami was the most powerful human being in the Curia. At that moment, with His Holiness Pope Julius XIV lying in state in St. Peter's Basilica, the body awaiting removal to the resurrection annex as soon as night should fall, Simon Augustino Cardinal Lourdesami was arguably the most powerful human being in the galaxy. The fact was not lost on the cardinal that morning.
"Are they here yet, Lucas?"
he rumbled to the man who had been his aide and factotum for more than 200 busy years. Monsignor Lucas Odi was as thin, bony, aged-looking and urgent in his movements as Cardinal Lourdesami was huge, fleshy, ageless and languid. Odi's full title as Under-Secretary of State for the Vatican was Substitute and Secretary of the Cipher, but he was usually known as the Substitute. Cipher might have been an equally apt nickname for the tall, angular Benedictine administrator, for in the 22 decades of smooth service he had given his master, no one, not even Lourdesami himself, knew the man's private opinions or emotions. Father Lucas Odi had been Lourdesami's strong right arm for so long that the Secretary Cardinal had long since ceased to think of him as anything but an extension of his own will. "They have just been seated in the innermost waiting room," answered Monsignor Odi. Cardinal Lourdesami nodded. For more than 1,000 years, since long before the Hegira that had sent humankind fleeing the dying earth and colonizing the stars, it had been a custom of the Vatican to hold important meetings in the waiting rooms of important officials rather than in their private offices. Secretary of State Cardinal Lourdesami's innermost waiting room was small, no more than 5 meters square, and unadorned, except for a round marble table with no inset comm units, a single window that, if it had not been polarized to opaqueness, would have looked out onto a marvelously frescoed external loggia, and 2 paintings by the 30th-century genius Caro Tan, one showing Christ's agony in Gethsemane, the other showing Pope Julius, in his pre-papal identity of Father Lennar Hoyt, receiving the first cruciform from a powerful but androgynous-looking archangel, while Satan, in the form of the shrike, looked on powerlessly. The 4 people in the waiting room, 3 men and a woman, represented the Executive Council of the Pan-Capitalist League of Independent Catholic Transstellar Trade Organizations, more commonly known as the Pax Mercantilis. 2 of the men might have been father and son, M. Helvig Aaron and M. Kenneth Hay Modino, alike even to their subtle, expensive cape suits, expensive conservative haircuts, subtly bio-sculpted Old Earth North Euro features, and to the even more subtle red pins showing their membership in the Sovereign Military Order of the Hospital of St. John of Jerusalem, of Rhodes, and of Malta, the ancient society popularly known as the Knights of Malta. The 3rd man was of Asian descent and wore a simple cotton robe. His name was Kenzo Isozaki, and he was this day, after Simon Augustino Cardinal Lourdesami, arguably the 2nd most powerful human in the Pax, the final Pax Mercantilis representative, a woman in her 50s, standard, with carelessly cropped dark hair and a pinched face, wearing an inexpensive work suit of combed fiber plastic, was M. Anna Pelli Cognani, reputedly Isozaki's heir apparent and rumored for years to be the lover of the female Archbishop of Renaissance Vector. The 4 rose and bowed slightly as Cardinal Lourdesami entered and took his place at the table. Monsignor Lucas Odi was the only bystander, and he stood away from the table, his bony hands clasped in front of his cassock, the tortured eyes of Carotan's Christ in Gethsemane peering over his black-frocked shoulder at the small assembly. M's Aaron and Haymodino moved forward to genuflect and kiss the cardinal's beveled sapphire ring. But Lord Usami waved away further protocol before Kenzo Isozaki or the woman could approach. When the four Pax Mercantilis representatives were seated once again, the cardinal said,
"We are all old friends. You know that while I represent the Holy See in this discussion, during the Holy Father's temporary absence, any and all things discussed this day shall remain within these walls."
Lord Usami smiled.
"And these walls, my friends, are the most secure and bug-proof in the Pax."
Aaron and Haymodino smiled tightly. M. Isozaki's pleasant expression did not change. M. Anna Pelikonyani's frown deepened.
"Your Eminence," she said, "may I speak freely?"
Lord Usami extended a pudgy palm. He had always distrusted people who asked to speak freely, or who vowed to speak candidly, or who used the expression frankly. He said,
"Of course, my dear friend. I regret that the pressing circumstances of the day allow us so little time."
Anna Pelikonyani nodded tersely. She had understood the command to be precise.
"Your Eminence," she said, "we asked for this conference so that we could speak to you not only as loyal members of His Holiness's Pan-Capitalist League, but as friends of the Holy See and of yourself."
Lord Usami nodded affably. His thin lips between the jowls were curled in a slight smile.
"Of course."
M. Helvig Aaron cleared his throat.
"Your Eminence, the Mercantilis has an understandable interest in the coming papal election."
The cardinal waited.
"Our goal today," continued M. Haymodino, "is to reassure Your Eminence, both as Secretary of State and as a potential candidate for the papacy, that the League will continue to carry out the Vatican's policy with the utmost loyalty after the coming election."
Cardinal Lord Dusami nodded ever so slightly. He understood perfectly. Somehow the Pax Mercantilis, Isozaki's intelligence network, had sniffed out a possible insurrection in the Vatican hierarchy. Somehow they had overheard the most silent of whispers in whisper-proof rooms such as this, that it had come time to replace Pope Julius with a new pontiff. And Isozaki knew that Simon Augustino Lord Usami would be that man.
"In this sad interregnum," M. Cognani was continuing, "we felt it our duty to offer private as well as public assurances that the League will continue serving the interests of the Holy See and the Holy Mother Church, just as it has for more than two standard centuries."
Cardinal Lord Usami nodded again and waited, but nothing else was forthcoming from the four Mercantilis leaders. For a moment, he allowed himself to speculate on why Isozaki had come in person.
"To see my reaction rather than trust the reports of his subordinates," he thought. "The old man trusts his senses and insights over anyone and anything else."
Lord Usami smiled.
"Good policy."
He let another minute of silence stretch before speaking.
"My friends," he rumbled at last, "you cannot know how it warms my heart to have four such busy and important people visit this poor priest in our time of shared sorrow."
Isozaki and Cognani remained expressionless, as inert as argon, but the cardinal could see the poorly hidden glint of anticipation in the eyes of the other two Mercantilis men. If Lord Usami welcomed their support at this juncture, however subtly, it put the Mercantilis on an even level with the Vatican conspirators, made the Mercantilis a welcomed conspirator and de facto co-equal to the next pope. Lord Usami leaned closer to the table. The cardinal noticed that M. Kenzo Isozaki had not blinked during the entire exchange.
"My friends," he continued, "as good born-again Christians,"
he nodded toward M's Aaron and Haymodino,
"as Knight's Hospitaller, You undoubtedly know the procedure for the election of our next pope. But let me refresh your memory. Once the cardinals and their interactive counterparts are gathered and sealed in the Sistine Chapel, there are three ways in which we can elect a pope. By acclamation, by delegation, or by scrutiny. Through acclamation, all of the cardinal electors are moved by the Holy Spirit to proclaim one person as supreme pontiff. We each cry, "Eligo, I elect," and the name of the person we unanimously select. Through delegation, we choose a few of those among us, say a dozen cardinals, to make the choice for all. Through scrutiny, the cardinal electors vote secretly until a candidate receives 2/3 majority plus one. Then the new pope is elected, and the waiting billions see the sfumata, the puffs of white smoke, which means that the family of the church once again has a holy father. The four representatives of the Pax Mercantilis sat in silence. Each of them was intimately aware of the procedure for electing a pope. Not only of the antiquated mechanisms, of course, but of the politicking, pressuring, deal-making, bluffing, and outright blackmail that had often accompanied the process over the centuries. And they began to understand why Cardinal Lourdesami was emphasizing the obvious now.
"For the last 9 elections," continued the huge cardinal, his voice a heavy rumble, "the pope has been elected by acclamation, by the direct intercession of the Holy Spirit."
Lourdesami paused for a long, thick moment. Behind him, Monsignor Oddi stood watching, as motionless as the painted Christ behind him, as unblinking as Kenzo Isozaki.
"I have no reason to believe," continued Lourdesami at last, "that this election will be any different."
The Pax Mercantilis executives did not move. Finally, M. Isozaki bowed his head ever so slightly. The message had been heard and understood. There would be no insurrection within the Vatican walls. Or if there were, Lourdesami had it well in hand and did not need the support of the Pax Mercantilis. If the former were the case, and Cardinal Lourdesami's time had not yet come, Pope Julius would once again oversee the church and Pax. Isozaki's group had taken a terrible risk because of the incalculable rewards and power that would be theirs if they had succeeded in allying themselves with the future pontiff. Now they faced only the consequences of the terrible risk. A century earlier, Pope Julius had excommunicated Kenzo Isozaki's predecessor for a lesser miscalculation, revoking the sacrament of the cruciform and condemning the Mercantilis leader to a life of separation from the Catholic community, which of course was every man, woman, and child on Pacem and on a majority of the Pax worlds, followed by the true death.
"Now I regret that pressing duties must take me from your kind company," rumbled the cardinal.
Before he could rise, and contrary to standard protocol for leaving the presence of a prince of the church, M. Isozaki came forward quickly, genuflected, and kissed the cardinal's ring.
"Eminence," murmured the old Pax Mercantilis billionaire.
This time, Lourdesami did not rise or leave until each of the powerful CEOs had come forward to show his or her respect. An Archangel-class starship translated into God's Grove space the day after Pope Julius's death. This was the only Archangel not assigned to courier duty. It was smaller than the new ships, and it was called the Raphael. Minutes after the Archangel established orbit around the ash-colored world, a dropship separated and screamed into atmosphere. 2 men and a woman were aboard. The 3 looked like siblings, united by their lean forms, pale complexions, dark, limp, short-cropped hair, hooded gazes, and thin lips. They wore unadorned ship suits of red and black, with elaborate wristband comm logs. Their presence in the dropship was a curiosity,
the Archangel-class starships invariably killed human beings during their violent translation through Planck space, and the onboard resurrection creches usually took 3 days to revive the human crew. These three were not human. Morphing wings and smoothing all surfaces into an aerodynamic shell, the dropship crossed the Terminator into daylight at Mach 3. Beneath it turned the former Templar world of God's Grove, a mass of burn scars, ash fields, mud flows, retreating glaciers, and green sequoias struggling to reseed themselves in the shattered landscape. Slowing now to subsonic speeds, the dropship flew above the narrow band of temperate climate and viable vegetation near the planet's equator, and followed a river to the stump of the former world tree. 83 kilometers across, still a kilometer high even in its devastated form, the stump rose above the southern horizon like a black mesa. The dropship avoided the world stump and continued to follow the river west, continuing to descend until it landed on a boulder near the point where the river entered a narrow gorge. The two men and the woman came down the extruded stairs and reviewed the scene. It was mid-morning on this part of God's Grove. The river made a rushing noise as it entered the rapids. Birds and unseen arboreals chittered in the thick trees farther downriver. The air smelled of pine needles, unclassifiable alien scents, wet soil and ash. More than 2.5 centuries earlier, this world had been smashed and slashed from orbit. Those 200-meter-high Templar trees that did not flee to space had burned in a conflagration that continued to rage for the better part of a century, extinguished at last only by a nuclear winter. "Careful," said one of the men, as the three walked downhill to the river. "The monofilaments she webbed here should still be in place." The thin woman nodded and removed a weapon laser from the flow foam pack she carried. Setting the beam to widest dispersal, she fanned it over the river. Invisible filaments glowed like a spider's web in morning dew, crisscrossing the river and wrapping around boulders, submerging and reemerging from the white frothed river. "None where we have to work," said the woman as she shut off the laser. The three crossed a low area by the river and climbed a rocky slope. Here the granite had been melted and flowed downhill like lava during the slagging of God's Grove. But on one of the terraced rock faces, there were even more recent signs of catastrophe. Near the top of a boulder 10 meters above the river, a crater had been burned into solid rock, perfectly circular, indented 0.5 meter below the level of the boulder. The crater was 5 meters across. On the southeast side, where a waterfall of molten rock had run and splattered and fountained to the river below, a natural staircase of black stone had formed. The rock filling the circular cavity on top of the boulder was darker and smoother than the rest of the stone, looking like polished onyx set in a granite crucible. One of the men stepped into the concavity, lay full length on the smooth stone, and set his ear to the rock. A second later he rose and nodded to the other two. "Stand back," said the woman. She touched her wristband comlog. The three had taken 5 steps back when the lance of pure energy burned from space. Birds and arboreals fled in loud panic through the screening trees. The air ionized and became superheated in seconds, rolling a shockwave in all directions. Branches and leaves burst into flame 50 meters from the beam's point of contact. The cone of pure brilliance exactly matched the diameter of the circular depression in the boulder, turning the smooth stone to a lake of molten fire. The two men and the woman did not flinch. Their ship suits smoldered in the open hearth furnace heat, but the special fabric did not burn. Neither did their flesh. "Time," said the woman over the roar of the energy beam and widening firestorm. The golden beam ceased to exist. Hot air rushed in at gale-force winds to fill the vacuum. The depression in the rock was a circle of bubbling lava. One of the men went to one knee and seemed to be listening. Then he nodded to the others and phase shifted. 1 second he was flesh and bone and blood and skin and hair. The next, he was a chrome-silver sculpture in the form of a man. The blue sky, burning forest, and lake of molten fire reflected perfectly on his shifting silver skin. He plunged one arm into the molten pool, crouched lower, reached deeper, and then pulled back. The silver form of his hand looked as if it had melted onto the surface of another silver human form, this one a woman. The male chrome sculpture pulled the female chrome sculpture out of the hissing, spitting cauldron of lava and carried it 50 meters to a point where the grass was not burning and the stone was cool enough to hold their weight. The other man and woman followed. The man shifted out of his chrome-silver form, and a second later, the female he had carried did the same. The woman who emerged from the quicksilver looked like a twin of the short-haired woman in the ship suit. "Where is the bitch child?" asked the rescued female. She had once been known as Radamanth Nemes. "Gone," said the man who rescued her. He and his male sibling could be her brothers or male clones. "They made the final Farcaster." Radamanth Nemes grimaced slightly. She was flexing her fingers and moving her arms as if recovering from cramps in her limbs. "At least I killed the damned android." "No," said the other woman, her twin. She had no name. "They left in the Raphael's dropship. The android lost an arm, but the autosurgeon kept him alive." Nemes nodded and looked back at the rocky hillside where lava still ran. The glow from the fire showed the glistening web of the monofilament over the river. Behind them, the forest burned. "That was not pleasant in there. I couldn't move with the full force of the ship's lance burning down on me, and then I could not phase shift with the rock around me. It took immense concentration to power down and still maintain an active phase shift interface. How long was I buried there?"
4 Earth years. Said the man who had not spoken until now.
Radamanth Nemes raised a thin eyebrow, more in question than surprise. "Yet the Corps knew where I was."
"The Corps knew where you were," said the other woman.
Her voice and facial expressions were identical to those of the rescued woman.
"And the Corps knew that you had failed."
Nemes smiled very thinly. "So the 4 years were a punishment?"
"A reminder,"
said the man who had pulled her from the rock. Radamanth Nemes took 2 steps, as if testing her balance. Her voice was flat.
"So why have you come for me now?"
"The girl," said the other woman.
"She is coming back. We ought to resume your mission."
Nemes nodded. The man who rescued her set his hand on her thin shoulder.
"And please consider," he said, "that 4 years entombed in fire and stone will be nothing to what you may expect if you fail again."
Nemes stared at him for a long moment without answering. Then, turning away from the lava and flames in a precisely choreographed motion, matching stride for stride, all 4 of them moved in perfect unison toward the dropship. On the desert world of Madre de Dios, on the high plateau called the Llano Estacado, because of the atmosphere generator pylons crisscrossing the desert in neat 10-kilometer grid intervals, Father Federico de Soya prepared for early morning mass. The little desert town of Nuevo Atlan held fewer than 300 residents, mostly Pax bauxite miners waiting to die before traveling home, mixed with a few of the converted Mariaists, who scratched out livings as corger herders in the toxic wastelands, and Father de Soya knew precisely how many would be in chapel for early mass. 4. Old M. Sanchez, the ancient widow who was rumored to have murdered her husband in a dust storm 62 years before. The Perel twins, who, for unknown reasons, preferred the old run-down church to the spotless and air-conditioned company chapel on the mining reservation. And the mysterious old man with the radiation-scarred face, who knelt in the rearmost pew and never took communion. There was a dust storm blowing. There was always a dust storm blowing.
and Father DeSoya had to run the last 30 meters from his adobe parish house to the church sacristy, a transparent fiber-plastic hood over his head and shoulders to protect his cassock and beretta, his breviary tucked deep in his cassock pocket to keep it clean. It did not work. Every evening when he removed his cassock or hung his beretta on a hook, the sand fell out in a red cascade, like dried blood from a broken hourglass. And every morning when he opened his breviary, sand gritted between the pages and soiled his fingers. "Good morning, Father," said Pablo as the priest hurried into the sacristy and slid the cracked weather seals around the door frame. "Good morning, Pablo, my most faithful altar boy," said DeSoya. Actually, the priest silently corrected himself. Pablo was his only altar boy. A simple child. Simple in the ancient sense of the word, as mentally slow, as well as in the sense of being honest, sincere, loyal, and friendly. Pablo was there to help DeSoya serve Mass every weekday morning at 06:30 hours and twice on Sunday. Although only the same four people came to the early morning Sunday Mass, and half a dozen of the bauxite miners to the later Mass. The boy nodded his head and grinned again, the smile disappearing for a moment as he pulled on his clean, starched surplice over his altar boy robes. Father DeSoya walked past the child, ruffling his dark hair as he did so, and opened the tall vestment chest. The morning had grown as dark as the high desert night, as the dust storm swallowed the sunrise, and the only illumination in the cold, bare room was from the fluttering sacristy lamp. DeSoya genuflected, prayed earnestly for a moment, and began donning the vestments of his profession. For 2 decades, as Father Captain DeSoya of the Pax Fleet, commander of torch ships such as the Balthazar, Federico DeSoya had dressed himself in uniforms where the cross and collar were the only signs of his priesthood. He had worn Plaskev battle armor, spacesuits, tactical comm implants, datum plane goggles, god gloves, all of the paraphernalia of a torch ship captain. But none of those items touched him and moved him, as much as these simple vestments of a parish priest. In the 4 years since Father Captain DeSoya had been stripped of his rank of captain and removed from fleet service, he had rediscovered his original vocation. DeSoya pulled on the amice that slipped over his head like a gown and fell to his ankles. The amice was white linen and immaculate, despite the incessant dust storms, as was the alb that slid on next. He set the cincture around his waist, whispering a prayer as he did so. Then he raised the white stole from the vestment chest, held it reverently a moment in both hands, and then placed it around his neck, crossing the 2 strips of silk. Behind him, Pablo was bustling around the little room, putting away his filthy outside boots and pulling on the cheap fiber-plastic running shoes his mother had told him to keep here just for Mass. Father DeSoya set his tunable in place, the outer garment showing a T-cross in front. It was white with a subtle purple piping. He would be saying a Mass of benediction this morning, while quietly administering the sacrament of penance for the presumed widow and murderer in the front pew, and the radiation-scarred cipher in the last pew. Pablo bustled up to him. The boy was grinning and out of breath. Father DeSoya set his hand on the boy's head, trying to flatten the thatch of flyaway hair, while also calming and reassuring the lad. DeSoya lifted the chalice, removing his right hand from the boy's head to hold it over the veiled cup, and said softly, "All right." Pablo's grin disappeared as the gravity of the moment swept over him. And then the boy led the procession of 2 out of the sacristy door toward the altar. DeSoy noticed at once that there were 5 figures in the chapel, not 4. The usual worshippers were there, all kneeling and standing, and then kneeling again in their usual places. But there was someone else, someone tall and silent, standing in the deepest shadows where the little foyer entered the nave. All during the renewed Mass, the presence of the stranger pulled at Father DeSoya's consciousness, try as he might to block out all but the sacred mystery of which he was part. "Dominus vobiscum," said Father de Soya. For more than 3,000 years, he believed, the Lord had been with them, with all of them.
Et cum spiritu tuo, said Father de Soya.
And as Pablo echoed the words, the priest turned his head slightly to see if the light had illuminated the tall, thin form in the dark recess at the front of the nave. It had not. During the canon, Father de Soya forgot the mysterious figure and succeeded in focusing all of his attention on the host that he raised in his blunt fingers.
Hoc est enim corpus meum, the Jesuit pronounced distinctly,
feeling the power of those words and praying for the 10,000th time that his sins of violence while a fleet captain might be washed away by the blood and mercy of this Savior. At the communion rail, only the Perel twins came forward, as always. De Soya said the words and offered the host to the young men. He resisted the urge to glance up at the figure in the shadows at the back of the church. The Mass ended almost in darkness. The howl of wind drowned out the last prayers and responses. This little church had no electricity, it never had, and the 10 flickering candles on the wall did little to pierce the gloom. Father de Soya gave the final benediction, and then carried the chalice into the dark sacristy, setting it on the smaller altar there. Pablo hurried to shrug out of his surplice and pull on his storm anorak.
See you tomorrow, Father.
Yes, thank you, Pablo. Don't forget.
Too late. The boy was out the door and running for the spice mill, where he worked with his father and uncles. Red dust filled the air around the faulty, weather-stripped door. Normally, Father de Soya would have been pulling off his vestments now, setting them back in the vestment chest. Later in the day, he would take them to the parish house to clean them. But this morning he stayed in the tunicle and stole, the alb and cincture and amice. For some reason he felt he needed them, much as he had needed the Plaskev battle armor during boarding operations in the coal sack campaign. The tall figure, still in shadows, stood in the sacristy doorway. Father de Soya waited and watched, resisting the urge to cross himself or to hold the remaining communion wafer up as if to shield against vampires or the devil. Outside, the wind went from a howl to a banshee scream. The figure took a step into the ruby light cast by the sacristy lamp. De Soya recognized Captain Margit Wu, personal aide and liaison for Admiral Maryusin, commanding officer of Pak's fleet. For the second time that morning, De Soya corrected himself. It was Admiral Margit Wu now, the pips on her collar just visible in the red light.
"Father Captain de Soya," said the admiral.
The Jesuit slowly shook his head. It was only 0730 hours on this 23-hour world, but already he felt tired.
"Just Father de Soya," he said.
"Father Captain de Soya,"
repeated Admiral Wu. And this time there was no question in her voice.
"You are hereby recalled to active service. You will take 10 minutes to gather your belongings and then come with me. The recall is effective now."
Federico de Soya sighed and closed his eyes. He felt like crying.
"Please, dear Lord, let this cup pass it from me."
When he opened his eyes, the chalice was still on the altar, and Admiral Margit Wu was still waiting.
"Yes," he said softly.
And slowly, carefully, he began removing his sacred vestments. On the third day after the death and entombment of Pope Julius XIV, there was movement in his resurrection creche. The slender umbilicals and subtle machine probes slid back and out of sight. The corpse on the slab at first lay inanimate, except for the rise and fall of a bare chest, then visibly twitched, then moaned, and, after many long minutes, raised itself to one elbow, and eventually sat up, the richly embroidered silk and linen shroud sliding around the naked man's waist. For several minutes, the man sat on the edge of the marble slab, his head in his shaking hands. Then he looked up as a secret panel on the Resurrection Chapel wall slid back with less than a hiss. A cardinal in formal red moved across the dimly lit space with a rustle of silk and a rattle of beads. Next to him walked a tall, handsome man with gray hair and gray eyes. This man was dressed in a simple but elegant one-piece suit of gray flannel. Three steps behind the cardinal and the man in gray came two Swiss guard troopers in medieval orange and black. They carried no weapons. The naked man on the slab blinked as if his eyes were unaccustomed to even the muted light in the dim chapel. Finally, the eyes focused.
"Lord Asami," said the resurrected man. "Father Dore," said Cardinal Lord Asami.
He was carrying an oversized silver chalice. The naked man moved his mouth and tongue, as if he had awakened with a vile taste in his mouth. He was an older man, with a thin, ascetic face, sad eyes, and old scars across his newly resurrected body. On his chest, two cruciforms glowed red and tumescent.
"What year is it?"
he asked at last.
"The year of our Lord, 3131," said the cardinal, still standing next to the seated man.
Father Paul Duret closed his eyes.
57 years after my last resurrection. 279 years after the fall of the Farcasters."
He opened his eyes and looked at the cardinal.
270 years since you poisoned me, killing Pope Teilhard the First."
Cardinal Lord Asami rumbled a laugh.
"You recover quickly from resurrection disorientation, if you can do your arithmetic so well."
Father Duray moved his gaze from the cardinal to the tall man in gray.
"Albedo, you come to witness? Or do you have to give courage to your tame Judas?"
The tall man said nothing.
Cardinal Lord Usami's already thin lips tightened to the point of disappearance between florid jowls. "Do you have anything else to say before you return to hell, anti-pope?" "Not to you," murmured Father Duray, and closed his eyes in prayer.
The two Swiss guard troopers seized Father Duray's thin arms. The Jesuit did not resist. One of the troopers grabbed the resurrected man by the brow and pulled his head back, stretching the thin neck in a bow. Cardinal Lord Asami took a graceful half-step closer. From the folds of his silken sleeve snicked a knife blade with a horn handle. While the troopers held the still passive Duray, whose Adam's apple seemed to grow more prominent as his head was forced back, Lord Asami swept his arm up and around in a fluid, casting-away gesture. Blood spurted from Duray's severed carotid artery. Stepping back to avoid staining his robes, Lord Asami slid the blade back into his sleeve, raised the broad-mouthed chalice, and caught the pulsing stream of blood. When the chalice was almost filled and the blood had ceased spurting, he nodded to the Swiss guard trooper, who immediately released Father Duray's head. The resurrected man was a corpse once again, head lolling, eyes still shut, mouth open, the slashed throat gaping like painted lips on a terrible, ragged grin. The two Swiss guard troopers arranged the body on the slab and lifted the shroud away. The naked dead man looked pale and vulnerable, torn throat, scarred chest, long white fingers, pale belly, flaccid genitals, scrawny legs. Death, even in an age of resurrection, leaves little or no dignity, even to those who have lived lives of sustained self-control. While the troopers held the beautiful shroud out of harm's way, Cardinal Lord Asami poured the heavy chalice's blood onto the dead man's eyes, into his gaping mouth, into the raw knife wound, and down the chest, belly, and groin of the corpse, the spreading scarlet matching and surpassing the intensity of color in the cardinal's robes.
"Sie aber sei nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich," said Cardinal Lord Asami. "You are not made of flesh, but of spirit."
The tall man raised an eyebrow.
Bach, isn't it?
Of course, said the cardinal, setting the now empty chalice next to the corpse. He nodded to the Swiss guard troopers, and they covered the body with the two-layered shroud. Blood immediately soaked the beautiful fabrics.
Jesu, meine Freunde, added Lourdesami.
I thought so, said the taller man.
He gave the cardinal a questioning look.
Yes, agreed Cardinal Lourdesami.
Now.
The man in gray walked around the bier and stood behind the two troopers, who were completing their tucking in of the blood-soaked shroud. When the troopers straightened and stepped back from the marble slab, the man in gray lifted his large hands to the back of each man's neck. The troopers' eyes and mouths opened wide, but they had no time to cry out. Within a second, their open eyes and mouths blazed with an incandescent light. Their skin became translucent to the orange flame within their bodies, and then they were gone, volatilized, scattered to particles finer than ash. The man in gray brushed his hands together to rid them of the thin layer of micro-ash.
A pity, Counselor Albedo, murmured Cardinal Lourdesami in his thick rumble of a voice.
The man in gray looked at the suggestion of airborne dust settling in the dim light, and then back at the cardinal. His eyebrow rose once again in query.
No, 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 rumbled Lourdesami. I mean the shroud. The stains will never come out. We have to weave a new one after every resurrection.
He turned and started toward the secret panel, his robes rustling.
Come, Albedo. We need to talk, and I still have a mass of thanksgiving to say before noon.
After the panel slid shut behind the two, the resurrection chamber lay silent and empty, except for the shrouded corpse, and the slightest hint of gray fog in the dim light, a shifting, fading mist, suggestive of the departing souls of the more recent dead. Chapter 2 On the week that Pope Julius died for the ninth time, and Father Duray was murdered for the fifth time, Ania and I were 160,000 light-years away on the kidnapped planet Earth. Old Earth. The real Earth. Circling a G-type star that was not the sun in the lesser Magellanic Cloud. A galaxy that was not the Earth's home galaxy. It had been a strange week for us. We did not know that the Pope had died, of course, since there was no contact between this relocated Earth and Pax Space, except for the dormant Farcaster portals. Actually, I know now Ania was aware of the Pope's demise through means we did not suspect then. But she did not mention events in Pax Space to us, and no one thought to ask her. Our lives on Earth during those years of exile were simple and peaceful and profound, in ways that are now hard to fathom and almost painful to recall. At any rate, that particular week had been profound but not simple or peaceful for us. The old architect with whom Ania had been studying for the last 4 years had died on Monday, and his funeral had been a sad and hasty affair out on the desert that wintry Tuesday evening. On Wednesday, Ania had turned 16, but the event was overshadowed by the pall of grief and confusion at the Taliesin Fellowship, and only Abetic and I had tried to celebrate the day with her. The android had baked a chocolate cake, Ania's favorite, and I had worked for days to whittle an elaborately carved walking stick out of a sturdy branch we had found during one of the old architect's compulsory picnic expeditions to the nearby mountains. That evening we ate the cake and drank some champagne in Ania's beautiful little apprentice shelter in the desert, but she was subdued and distracted by the old man's death and the fellowship's panic. I realize now that much of her distraction must have come from her awareness of the Pope's death, of the violent events that were gathering on the future's horizon, and of the end of what would be the most peaceful 4 years we would ever know together. I remember the conversation that evening of Ania's 16th birthday. It had grown dark early and the air was chill.
outside the comfortable stone and canvas home she had built 4 years earlier for her apprenticeship challenge. The dust was blowing and the sagebrush and yucca plants rasped and contorted in the wind's grip. We sat by the hissing lantern, traded our champagne glasses for mugs of warm tea, and talked softly beneath the hiss of sand on canvas. "It's strange," I said. "We knew he was old and ill, but no one seemed to believe that he would die." I was speaking of the old architect, of course, not of the distant Pope who meant so little to us. And like all of us on the exiled earth, Aeneas' mentor had not carried the cruciform. His death was final in the way the Pope's could not be. "He seemed to know," Aeneas said softly. "He's been calling in each of his apprentices for the past month, imparting some last bit of wisdom."
"What last bit of wisdom did he share with you?" I asked. "I mean, if it's not a secret or too personal."
Aeneas smiled over the steaming mug of tea. "He reminded me that the patron will always agree to pay twice what the bid was. If you send along the extra expenses bit by bit, once construction is started and the structure is taking shape. He said that was beyond the point of no return, so the client was hooked like a trout on a 6-pound line." Both Abetic and I laughed. It was not a disrespectful laugh. The old architect had been one of those rare creatures, a true genius combined with an overpowering personality. But even when thinking of him with sadness and affection, we could recognize the selfishness and deviousness that had also been part of his personality. And I don't mean to be coy here by referring to him only as the old architect. The Cybrid's personality template had been reconstructed from a pre-Hegira human named Frank Lloyd Wright, who had worked in the 19th and 20th centuries, A.D. But while everyone at the Taliesin Fellowship had referred to him respectfully as Mr. Wright, including even those older apprentices who were his age, I had always thought of him as the old architect, because of things Aeneas had said about her future mentor before we came here to Old Earth. As if thinking along these same lines, Abetic said, "It's odd, isn't it?" "What's that?" said Aeneas. The android smiled and rubbed his left arm where it ended at a smooth stump just below the elbow. It is a habit he had developed over the past few years. The autosurgeon on the dropship that had carried us through the Farcaster from God's Grove had kept the android alive, but his chemistry had been sufficiently different to prevent the ship from growing him a new arm. "I mean," he said, "that despite the ascendancy of the Church in the affairs of humankind, the question of whether human beings have a soul which leaves the body after death has yet to be definitely answered. Yet in Mr. Wright's case, we know that his cybrid personality still exists separate from his body, or at least did for some time after the moment of his death."
"Do we know that for sure?"
I said.
The tea was warm and good.
Aeneas and I bought it, traded for it, actually, at the Indian market located in the desert where the city of Scottsdale should have been. It was Aeneas who answered my question. "Yes. My father's cybrid personality survived the destruction of his body and was stored in the Shrone Loop in Mother's skull. Even after that, we know that it had a separate existence in the Megasphere and then resided in the Consul's ship for a time. A cybrid's personality survives as a sort of holistic wavefront propagated along the matrices of the datum plane, or megasphere, until it returns to the AI source in the core."
I had known this, but never understood it.
"Okay," I said.
"But where did Mr. Wright's AI-based personality wavefront go? There can't be any connections to the core out here in the Magellanic Cloud. There are no dataspheres here."
Aeneas set down her empty mug. "There has to be a connection, or Mr. Wright and the other reconstructed cybrid personalities assembled here on Earth couldn't have existed. Remember, the Technocore used the Planck space between the Farcaster portals as their medium and hiding place before the dying hegemony destroyed the Farcaster openings to it."
"The void which binds," I said, repeating the phrase from the old poet's cantos.
"Yeah," said Aeneas. "Although I always thought that was a dumb name."
Whatever it's called, I said. I don't understand how it can reach here, a different galaxy.
The medium the Corps used for farcasters reaches everywhere, said Aenea. It permeates space and time.
My young friend frowned.
No, that's not right. Space and time are bound up in it. The void which binds transcends space and time.
I looked around. The lantern light was enough to fill the little tent structure, but outside it was dark and the wind howled.
Then the Corps can reach here?
Aenea shook her head. We had held this discussion before. I had not understood the concept then. I did not understand it now.
These cybrids are connected to AIs which aren't really part of the Corps, she said. Mr. Wright's persona wasn't. My father, the second Keat cybrid, wasn't.
This was the part I had never understood.
The Kanto said that the Keat cybrids, including your father, were created by Uman, a Corps AI. Uman told your father that the cybrids were a Corps experiment.
Aenea stood and walked to the opening of her apprentice shelter. The canvas on either side rippled with the wind, but kept its shape and held the sand outside. She had built it well.
Uncle Martin wrote the Kantos, she said. He told the truth as best he could, but there were elements he did not understand.
Me too, I said and dropped the matter. I walked over and put my arm around Aenea, feeling the subtle changes in her back and shoulder and arm since the first time I had hugged her 4 years earlier. Happy birthday, kiddo. She glanced up at me, and then laid her head against my chest.
Thank you, Rol.
There had been other changes in my youthful friend since first we met when she was just turning 12 standard. I could say that she had grown to womanhood in the intervening years, but despite the rounding of her hips and obvious breasts beneath the old sweatshirt she wore, I still did not see her as a woman. No longer a child, of course, but not yet a woman. She was Aenea. The luminous dark eyes were the same. Intelligent, questioning, a bit sad with some secret knowledge. And the effect of being physically touched when she turned the attention of her gaze on you was as strong as ever. Her brown hair had grown somewhat darker in the past few years. She had cut it the previous spring. Now it was shorter than mine had been when I was in the Home Guard military on Hyperion a dozen years earlier. When I set my hand on her head, the hair was barely long enough to rise between my fingers. But I could see some glints of the old blonde streaks there, brought out by the long days she spent working in the Arizona sunlight. As we stood there listening to the blowing dust scraping canvas, abetic a silent shadow behind us, Aenea took my hand in both of hers. She might have been 16 that day, a young woman rather than a girl, but her hands were still tiny in my huge palm.
Rol, she said.
I looked at her and waited.
Will you do something for me? She said softly, very softly.
Yes, I did not hesitate. She squeezed my hand and looked directly into me then.
Will you do something for me tomorrow?
Yes. Neither her gaze nor the pressure on my hand let up.
Will you do anything for me?
This time I did hesitate. I knew what such a vow might entail, even though this strange and wonderful child had never asked me to do anything for her, had not asked that I come with her on this mad odyssey. That had been a promise I had made to the old poet, Martin Silenus, before I had even met Aenea. I knew that there were things that I could not, in good conscience or bad, bring myself to do.